Welcome to this episode of the Biology of Trauma podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Amy. One of the most overlooked aspects of healing is how our modern environment silently works against our biology. For most of my life, I was fighting against my own biology and not understanding why inner work and therapy was hard, and I struggled to make progress. But what if the key to the healing journey was not working harder, but allowing our body to engage its own healing mechanisms? This episode was inspired by a question from Joe on LinkedIn, who wrote in to me and said, I've been curious if there is a best time of day for me to do inner work. Joe, I will come back to answer your question at the end of this episode. Wellness mama, health journalist, and expert Katie Wells joins me for this episode on biological rhythms of wellness, where you will learn why trauma responses are fundamentally an energy problem, the vital role of circadian rhythm and light exposure in healing, what safety signals are and their impact on your health and healing journey, practical steps you can implement to improve your energy and healing, and why it's important to work with the natural rhythms of your body. The rhythm of rest and recovery that elite athletes use that we could apply to our lives for our benefit as well. Whether you are a practitioner or someone navigating your own healing journey, this episode offers practical tools to align with the natural rhythms of our body, create that environment that supports rather than depletes our energy. Also, don't forget, we release new episodes twice a week now. So hit subscribe and follow so you don't miss out on an episode, and let's dive in. Like, how did you get onto this path of wanting to learn and study living in such a way that would best promote your family's health?
The short version really is, it's never the plan I had for my life, but kind of a perfect storm of two things happened somewhat simultaneously. So when I had my first son, I, at that point, was having some strange health symptoms that I would be told were very common after having a baby or just part of being a woman, or that everything was, quote, normal. And it would take years to find my own health answers. But also when my oldest son was 6 weeks old, I was sitting in the doctor's office nursing him, waiting for the doctor who was called into a birth. And so I was reading every magazine in the waiting room as I waited. And I believe it was Time magazine, but one of the articles I read said that for the first time in two centuries, the current generation of American children would have a shorter life expectancy than their parents. And it went on to detail how we would see the rise of what we're now seeing: chronic disease, heart disease, cancer, autoimmunity, diabetes, kind of the things we're already seeing play out in the statistics for our kids. And my background up to that point was actually journalism, not health and wellness at all, or nutrition, or any of it. And so I had no idea, for one, what was creating that drastic rise in the span of one generation, or how I could possibly help. But holding my little newborn that day and seeing what his generation was going to face, it kind of ignited a fire in me to at least figure out why that was happening and to see what within my own power I could shift that would change that statistic for him, and then hopefully for other kids as well. And so those two things lined up: both the research of my own health struggles that took 8 years and many doctors to finally get answers to and that now are fully resolved, and seeing what our kids would face. I turned that research background toward health and wellness and root cause, and really asking that question, getting curious around why are we seeing these shifts so quickly and so drastically, and what can we do? What is within our power, especially as moms, to shift those statistics for our own kids and for other kids as well?
In my audience, I have a lot of moms, but I also have a lot of practitioners who work with moms and kids. And as you have been doing this research and study, what is the impact that you would want them to understand of this is the environment in which we live in now? This is why we need to take these things seriously. We can't ignore them and expect our children to be healthy and happy and resilient. What's going on in the world today that is different?
Such a good question. And certainly it's multifaceted. And I know there's many experts who explain this in various versions of kind of the bucket analogy of that. It's important to remember the body is incredibly adaptable, incredibly resilient, and always working toward healing. So we're starting with an incredible tool that we're living in our bodies. However, in the last 50 years, especially, we are seeing a lot more inputs go into those buckets or that bathtub or whatever the thimble, whatever you want to use as the analogy, than we ever have throughout history. And kind of the idea is, if you have any kind of container, say a bathtub, you can put really whatever you want to put in that bathtub. But once it reaches the top, no matter what's in it, whether it's coffee and tea and marbles and Orbeez and stuffed animals, whatever you put in that bathtub, when it reaches the top, it's going to overflow. And that overflow is what we see as health problems or chronic disease, or it's going to look different, possibly for different people based on genetics or based on where they might already have kind of a weakness going on. But once we reach the kind of that threshold, it's going to overflow and we're going to see something happen. And so the good news about that too is it doesn't require perfection. We don't have to have an empty bathtub. We don't have to have zero negative inputs. We just have to be aware that the body is resilient, it is adaptable, and it has a threshold. And so if we can be aware of that, we can kind of pick and choose. We can 80-20. We can be aware of the really big offenders and give ourselves some bandwidth and some leeway. And we know that there's resilience there. We don't have to be perfect about it. I think actually that's more stressful. And then we're adding the stress of trying to be perfect, which is one of those inputs that goes into the bathtub. I know you talk about the stress piece a lot of like, even if we're doing everything perfectly in a physical health sense, if we're doing it all from a place of stress and fear and overwhelm, we're still putting those inputs into that bathtub. And so it's realizing things like easy shifts. Like if we can set up the light environment in our house to be a little bit more circadian friendly, especially for kids, that's actually a huge signaling mechanism for our physical health, for our nervous system. And once we set it up, there's no extra effort required. It's things like 80% of the time, can we eat a really nutritious, nutrient-focused diet in our houses and not freak out if sometimes we eat out and we're not home or we're traveling and the food might not be perfect? Can we avoid some of the really big offenders in air fresheners or in most laundry detergents and just choose slightly more natural options when we're buying those things? Zero effort required once we make the switch. Can we make sure our sleep environment is really set up for high quality sleep? I think this is actually one of the biggest levers we can pull. I know you talk about the importance of sleep as well, but it's kind of, if you don't get that piece figured out, everything else feels harder and actually is harder if we're not getting good sleep. So especially for our kids, can we really make sure we curate the sleep environment, our sleep routine, make sleep a priority, which gives us more resilience and bandwidth in those other areas as well. And then of course, there's personalized things we can do beyond that. But the beauty is it's like those free or very inexpensive foundational things that actually make the biggest difference in the long run. And then I would add, of course, addressing the nervous system side and the emotional side. That was actually one of my most impactful pieces that took me years and years to actually figure out was going to be impactful. And you, I know, teach people that. I feel like all of those together help us to create some more room in that bathtub so we don't reach that overflow point and that threshold and see kind of the cascade of problems that happen after that.
Yes. And this is why I love your work, Katie, because you bring in all of this biology piece that I had neglected. I hadn't even realized how much this was a part of emotional resilience as well. But as I, you know, have looked at one's capacity, I've really come down to this conclusion that a trauma response is an energy problem. That's it. A trauma response is because I did not have enough energy to be able to respond in the way that would overcome the problem. So then I started looking at all of my life and realizing all of the things that were part of my environment that were draining my energy. My sleep, draining my energy. It wasn't helping me. It was draining my energy. The food I was eating, the circadian rhythm, the lights. There's all this stuff in our modern environments that actually drain our energy. And how can we expect that to not have an impact? So one of the things that I tell people a lot is it's a bit silly to go to therapy and try to do all of this personal development when your body biologically does not have the energy to make the changes. Change requires energy. And so how can we be bringing in these things into our world, into our modern day, that will actually fuel our ability to do trauma work and not leave us wanting to, but literally physically not having the energy and the capacity to make any change in our body?
Yeah, that's such a good point. And I feel like with everything within your approach, it's so holistic and it takes into account all of these pieces and how we can use them to kind of create that positive flywheel when we understand them. And I think to your point, exactly, like both mentally, emotionally, and physically, they all work together. And if we don't even have baseline physical energy, or we're not, like, our mitochondria are not being effective, we're not making enough ATP, we can't out-willpower that. We're lacking a basic biological energy. And so if that's the case, and even if we're not, increasing our biological energy is kind of universally beneficial as well. So it becomes, how do we, understanding that, how do we do things that help us have more physical energy, especially if we're starting from a point where we already are low physical energy? And I think here is where some of the really easy levers come into play first. It's not a trying to overhaul your life overnight situation. It's a like really high ROI baby steps that slowly help you increase your energy so that you have capacity to do the bigger things, to do the therapy, to do the work, to make the bigger shifts in your lifestyle. But where can we start with those baby steps? And I think a couple that we already touched on, but I really want to highlight are the light and the sleep. I think those are actually two of the biggest levers we can pull when it comes to every aspect of our health. In fact, there's a study called the camping study where people were camping in nature for a span of less than 7 days, but with no artificial lights. They weren't on their phones. They didn't have artificial light flashlights. They were purely in a nature environment. And within the span of 1 week, their labs drastically changed. Their cortisol levels drastically changed. Their sleep problems went away. They resolved a lot of these kind of chronic issues they had in less than a week, which to me is really a testament to how incredible the body is and how rapidly it adapts when we give it the right inputs. And I also, for me, the takeaway there is not that we all need to go camp in the woods for 7 days, although the data is pretty strong on that, but most of us don't have the ability to do that. But what can we learn from that? Can we simply reduce the artificial light that we're getting at night right before bed? Can we, you know, minimize just a little the screen time that we're on throughout the day, especially after sunset? Can we get morning sunlight, which across the board, there's tremendous data on the benefits of simply going outside in the morning as soon as possible after waking up and what that does for our hormones, for our cortisol, for our circadian biology. Not to mention that early morning spectrum of light includes red light, which people pay thousands of dollars for fancy red lights. It's available for free every sunrise and sunset, and we can just go outside and get it. It's there every day. Those little shifts, you might be shocked at how big of a difference they make, especially when it comes to your ATP and to your energy levels, because they're so connected to hormones and sleep. And then I would also say, if possible, and try to make it a priority, get at least 10 or 20 minutes of bright midday sun. More is better if you can handle it without burning. But that full spectrum midday light has so many benefits, especially for mitochondria. So when we're talking about physical energy, that's actually one of the highest ROI things you can do that's free, is just spending time in the sunshine. Not only does that improve your ATP production in your body, it actually can increase the nutrients you absorb from the food you eat by as much as 500%. So even if you don't change your diet, you can absorb up to 500% more nutrients from that food by getting the right amount of light exposure. I think minerals are a big component there too, and hopefully we're eating a nutrient-dense diet. But just the light alone can drastically shift energy levels and how we're feeling, and it's free. So that's when I encourage people, like, even if you have very low energy, go lay in the sunshine for 10 minutes in the middle of the day. Just walk outside and just lay down on the ground in the sun. The little baby steps can make such a big difference.
That light does make a big difference. And I, even as a physician, like, I wasn't taught that in medical school, Katie. These are things that are free and available to us. They're part of nature. And yet we've missed some of this as we've gotten more modern and more focused on technology. And we'll go spend thousands of dollars for these red light therapies and these other things that actually we can have available to us. But also it's that rhythm that you're talking about. It's not just the light. It's the rhythm of the light and how we can help the body establish these rhythms. The body does have rhythms. And I even remember when I was at your home for Thanksgiving and you then went on a walk with the kids after Thanksgiving dinner. This idea that the body has rhythms, rhythms for eating, rhythms of light, rhythms of movement and walking. So tell me about what your rhythms look like for how you support your best health.
Oh, I love the acknowledgement of rhythms. And I think this is such a great question. And also that our earth has rhythms. Our bodies have rhythms, especially for women. And the moon cycle, like so many rhythms seem to kind of overlap and give insight into each other. And to your point, I think it's actually not so much any of these actions in and of themselves, but the consistency and the rhythm of doing them over and over, those small changes over time are really what add up to the biggest difference. And I would say, with the caveat also of always listening to your body. So I also say I don't do anything every single day, including take supplements. I take days off. Usually the weekends I take off from supplements. I might get some form of movement, for instance, every single day. I sleep every single day, but I'm not doing the same exercise every single day. I'm not eating the same thing every single day. In fact, some days I fast and I don't eat at all. I think the adaptability and the override of always listening to our body when we're actually tuning into it is very, very important. But that said, I think if we build into our routine some really basic, and these are so basic and foundational, I think it's easy to overlook the simple things because of their simplicity. And often when we do them regularly, they are the most profoundly impactful to us over time. And so I think of these in a few kind of core categories, again, with the caveat that I always have the override of listening to my body. So I, for instance, most days do some form of movement. If my body one day does not want any kind of movement and wants to rest, I listen to that. Or if it really one day wants to go a lot harder, but that wasn't in my plan, I listen to that as well. But the categories within kind of the daily rhythms that I think about a lot and really try to tune into are the ones we've mentioned already, of the light, especially. Like I would say that's my biggest non-negotiable, and that I do go outside every single day for some amount of time. That is a pretty much non-negotiable. Same thing with like basic hydration. A couple really easy switches people can do that don't even actually have to change your routine, but just change the order of your routine and make a big difference when it comes to your stress hormones. For me, these all kind of tie into the morning routine and the morning rhythm. And if you set yourself up for success the night before with this, it doesn't actually have to require any effort. So I sleep with a quart-sized mason jar of mineral water on my nightstand. And so as soon as I wake up, because we do lose a decent amount of water just through our exhale of our breath while we're sleeping, as soon as I wake up, I take that glass of water. Ideally, I go outside barefoot, stand in the morning light, and drink that water. But my rhythm there being that hydration and sunshine before screens or caffeine. Another one that especially for women is often very helpful, like a little small switch, is to get protein and micronutrients before caffeine as well. And I know it's really easy to want to wake up and go straight to coffee, but for female hormones especially, if we can get the safety signals of protein and micronutrients before our body experiences caffeine, that actually sends a really strong safety signal to the body that nutrients are abundant, that we are not in a stressful situation. And it actually makes the caffeine ironically more effective because we're also waiting for that window where our adenosine pathways get to function naturally. And so you don't have to not drink coffee or not get on your screens in the morning. It's just those little subtle shifts to the order of which we do them. I know a lot of women have experimented with intermittent fasting or time-restricted eating, which I have as well, and I believe it can be a valuable tool. But my tip here would be to shift that window earlier so that you're taking advantage of that morning protein and micronutrient window as close as possible after waking up, ideally within 30 minutes. And if you're going to stop eating within a restricted window, stop eating around sunset. I know that's a little controversial. Ironically, I got a lot of heat on my social media one day suggesting that we simply don't eat after sunset. But back to that camping study and the circadian biology aspect, the body then has way more time to digest before we go to bed. So we're getting to sleep in a more restful state where our body can focus on deep healing versus just digestion. And so we typically have deeper sleep that way, which also helps the circadian cycle. But for women especially, the other key there is that we're getting the protein and the micronutrients first thing in the morning. When it comes to food in general, that's actually been the shift in my approach. I kind of now have moved away from any diet that you would call it or any kind of paradigm of eating. And my focus really is beyond just listening to my body, but how do I get the most nutrients in whatever meal I'm going to eat? So anytime I'm going to eat, how do I maximally nourish my body? How do I send the most safety signals possible through this meal, through a combination of really nutrient-dense foods, especially ones that align the most with my body? I tend to not share exactly what I eat or exactly what supplements I take because for me, that's actually been a long process of dialing those things in. And I have figured out what works for me. If I shared that exact list, it would not work exactly the same for anyone else. It's more of the foundation of the experimentation, of doing that end of one study of self, which I think is the most valuable study we can undertake in this lifetime, is the study of self and figuring out those pieces for each of us. And I think within the daily rhythms, actually what it all falls under as a category is something that you also talk a lot about, which is how do we send safety signals to our body? How do we even understand the difference between stress signals and safety signals? And then as much as possible, reinforce with our body in our routines and our rhythms and in our day, the safety signals of like, look, I'm aligned with natural light and nature. That's a safety signal. I'm getting enough food. Women chronically undereat often, actually were at least undernourished, if not also underfed often. So how do I nourish my body to tell it it is safe? We are not in a famine. You do not have to preserve every resource because we're in a famine. How do I, through my breath, send safety signals to my body that my nervous system is safe? How do I, through daily movement, which for me often will just be, I'll take phone calls and walk. And so my exercise of the day is just walking 5 miles, I'm getting movement. So how do I, through my movement, send safety signals to my body? I will say, when I was in the intensive trauma healing phase, there was about a solid 2 years, I did not do any high intensity exercise at all because I realized my nervous system was trying to recover. And any extreme workout was a stress signal that my body did not handle well. My nervous system did not handle well. And so during that time, I did really gentle swims in the ocean. I went for really gentle walks in the sunshine and I did very gentle yoga and that was it. And my body needed that time. And I also slept a whole bunch and ate a lot of really small nutrient dense meals. And as I healed and as my capacity increased, my body naturally wanted to do things like lift weights and go for sprints, but I couldn't force those things. I had to listen to my body. So all that to say, I feel like it all fits under the category of safety signals, and in particular, figuring out for yourself what those safety signals are, because you could take the exact blueprint I do every day. It wouldn't work exactly the same for you, but you can use those ideas as a springboard to figuring out for you what are the biggest safety signals you can send.
Oh, Katie, as I listen to you, I'm going to ask you a question around, have you always been this attuned to your body? Because this requires a level of attunement that a mother would have with her baby, right? Where the baby's not able to communicate with words what they need, but just by the squirms and the look on their face, the mom knows exactly what they need. And that seems to be the level of attunement that you have with your body. And not everyone has that. Has that always been the case for you?
Oh, such a good question. And the short answer is no. And actually, you hit the nail on the head because even when I had tried to do inner child work in therapy, I had always kind of been able to dodge it, or I knew how to, like, oh, this is the language we use when we talk to our inner child. The paradigm shift for me actually was realizing with my own kids, what they needed, of course, was not me to talk to them in therapy language or like do any of those things. They needed the energetic feeling of my presence. They needed me to be there and listen, like listen with my body, listen with my heart and my emotions, what they needed, not just what they said, not just what their temper tantrum said. They needed to feel seen and understood. And slowly, it finally clicked for me. I'm like, that's actually what my inner child needs as well. It doesn't need therapy. It needs to feel seen and held and safe and heard. And at the time, actually, like I was pretty much completely the opposite. Like after trauma in high school, I was so dissociated from my body. I thought I just had a spectacular pain tolerance because I could just basically not feel pain. Turns out I was just really good at actually not existing in my body at all. And so I had to really relearn that process. And it was really uncomfortable at times, honestly. And it was a beautiful journey and a beautiful process. And along that journey, ironically, all my physical health problems eventually reversed as I learned to really actually tune in and listen to my body and not try to override it. That was a pattern for so long. I tried to just like punish my body into doing what I wanted or shame it into being a certain way or give it all the supplements to make it do what I wanted it to do. And it turns out actually befriending your body is way more effective and more pleasant than any of those things. I actually read a quote years ago that said, I said to my body, I want to be your friend. And it took a deep breath and said, I've been waiting our whole life for this. And I felt like that's what that journey was for me.
And that's a challenge for a lot of people and practitioners. I'll be honest with you, because as a practitioner, even going through medical school and my training, it was comforting to have a protocol. It was comforting to have that list of, this is what everybody does. This is the list. This is the protocol of supplements or whatever it is. And so this idea of opening up and being like, well, actually, the most important thing is for you to be so in tune with your body that you know what supplements it needs that day, that you know whether it wants gentle movement or the aggressive sprint down the street. You know these things because then that's when you will be in your best health, aligning with your body rather than fighting it and being misattuned. So how do you actually get those signals from your body? Is this a form of muscle testing that you're doing? Is this just sensing what your body needs? And how do you get those senses and those messages?
Yeah, well, I'm with you on the safety and the like comfort of protocols and systems and checklists. And when I started, I literally had spreadsheets of supplements and when I was taking them and which ones and all of that. And that structure felt safe at that time. And I think if I had just tried to like overnight shift all of these things, it actually would have felt very unsafe. So it was a slow learning process in kind of making little changes and listening as I went. I also feel like in some sense, this is an area that will be a little bit different for everybody. And I feel like the body is very good at communicating. So it's once we learn that communication, it gets easier and easier and a lot more intuitive. But especially if you were like me and kind of totally not even really living in your body for a long time, it's a little bit of a slow process to befriend your body again and to learn how to listen to it and to learn how to listen to what it's actually saying, not what the stress cue underneath it might be. So for me, this was like a very slow experimentation. And thankfully, I was able to pick up pretty early, like, oh, okay, my body is requesting a lot more rest than I'm giving it. And when I started resting more, that increased my resilience and my capacity a little bit, which gave me a little bit more bandwidth to do some of the other experimentation. But I do think that kind of that concept of safety signals versus stress signals, that alone is a great experimentation starting point. Because even though we're all so different, there are some kind of universal commonalities within the body of things that feel universally for the most part safe or universally for the most part stressful. Like the body does need nutrition and those kinds of inputs. The body does need sleep and those kinds of inputs. The body does need light in some form. So we can kind of start with those and then learn to listen beyond then. And I don't do any kind of muscle testing. I know some people that works great for them. For me, over time, this has seemed to be more of a sensing or like almost an inner voice. It doesn't sound like an actual voice talking to me, but like a really strong inner sense. It's almost like a compass of if something is a yes or a no, or even a couple times I'll get like a very strong feeling in my head, not like someone's talking to me, but like a feeling in my head of like, nope. Or I've joked before, like sometimes someone would say something and I would hear like almost internally, like, that's BS. Like I learned to listen to that over time. But I think that is a befriending process. It's a little bit of a slow journey and also a very worthwhile one.
And what it creates is this trust. Because as you listen and then respond to your body starts to know that you are listening as opposed to the experience that it's had for, you know, a long time, which is they're not listening, which means that I have to get really loud. And that's what my body did. My body had to get really loud before I even realized that I wasn't listening to it.
Yeah, it seems like that's a very common experience as well. And for me too, like it took me getting pretty deep into Hashimoto's before I even got the diagnosis of Hashimoto's. And I now say that was a word that was given to me that no longer applies to me, but I was told at that point that I had Hashimoto's. At the time, I adopted that story that my body was attacking itself, that my body was attacking my thyroid. And that definitely brought in a whole new wave of emotion. And over time, I actually had to learn the importance of our inner dialogue and how much our body responds to what we're saying, even the things we're just saying internally to ourselves, and how disempowering it was to say that my body was attacking itself. We talked about this when you came on my podcast, but I realized slowly that if my body wanted to hurt me, it could kill me instantly, that my body was always on my side. And even when there were symptoms, those were clear communication from my body while it was still doing whatever it possibly could to the best of its ability to protect me, to live optimally. So if it wasn't getting the results that I wanted, how could I better listen to that communication from my body? And how could I give it what it was requesting so that it would actually be able to thrive optimally? Because that's what the body's already trying to do all the time. It's wired for that. And so over time, for me, that process looked like I eventually reversed all those things. And I've now had 2 years of completely normal labs with no medication, zero antibodies present. And I no longer have the word of Hashimoto's associated with my health. I actually say I'm not in remission. It's no longer present at all. Like on lab results, it's non-detectable. And that just reinforced again, the body is infinitely capable of healing. It is absolutely incredible. And when we align our minds, our emotions, and all the things we're doing for our physical health, it's incredible how quickly and how completely I feel like the body is capable of healing.
Ah, oh, Katie, I still remember the day that I got my lab results showing that all of my autoimmunity had gone away. Like you say, it's not just in remission, like the labs are completely normal. And just that amazement at what my body had been able to do once we got on the same team. And as I look at what you do and what you're saying, it reminds me of the book Peak Performance. And that book really helped my mind shift around this idea of, no, my body is actually built for stress. My body wants to do big things. It wants to have a challenge and it wants to overcome that challenge. The idea for life is not sitting on the beach drinking a margarita all day, every day. It wants to have a challenge. It's just that I've been approaching it wrong and I haven't set up this rhythm of stress and then rest, stress and rest. But this is what you do even from the moment that you wake up, where you drink the mineral water, you ground yourself, you get the sunlight, you're resourcing yourself first, and then it has the resources to do big things. And whether that big thing is a podcast or whether that big thing is an exercise, whatever that big thing is, your body is going into that resourced. And then it sounds like you're giving it that recovery. So for you, what has that relationship between the thriving and being able to do big things and putting our bodies into a stress mode in a positive way and balancing that with the rest so that we have the growth that we want?
Oh, this is such a good question. And actually working with athletes has been really helpful for me in learning this and learning the degree to which this is actually really, really important. So a few years ago, I went down a rabbit hole of research when a lot of genetic data started coming out because I realized there was this tendency to hyper-focus on kind of certain genes in isolation and try to treat them in isolation. And then people were throwing all these other genes out of alignment because they were like giving their body, for instance, too many methylated B vitamins and then messing up these other genes. So I started experimenting with an algorithm that would, as much as possible, look at someone's genes and kind of weigh all of those factors to more accurately figure out what did this particular person need in what amounts. And that ended up being pretty effective. So I ended up working with a lot of elite athletes and it was really fun and impactful to get to work with them. But one thing that really stood out to me with them was they train incredibly, incredibly hard. And then when they're not training, they rest like it is their job, like non-negotiably they rest. And I realized that concept carries over. Like in order for them to be world-class performers, they actually have to honor the rest even more than the training. Like they can get away with a little bit less training. They can't get away with a little bit less recovery. And I realized to some degree, I say like moms are also sort of extreme athletes. I even in a stand-up comedy, but I compare moms to special forces because of the amount of things that we can deal with on a day-to-day basis. But that means we need actually to honor that recovery as well. I think there's a tendency to think of rest and recovery as a weakness, especially in a society that glamorizes busyness and glamorizes how hard we can grind. But we really, when we honor the rest and the recovery, that's actually where the beautiful results happen. And there's a lot of data showing we actually, whether it be in athletics, whether it be in deep cognitive work, we can only do about 3 to 4 hours a day of that deep work in whatever form before our performance sharply declines. And a lot of us, I know as an entrepreneur, I went through many years of trying to do 12 plus hour days. And even if I felt that decline, I tried to push through it, which was really not helpful for my nervous system. And I've over time learned if I honor that rhythm, if I honor the fact that the body can be really incredible for those 3 to 4 hours and have phenomenal output if you let it rest after, I can actually get more done in those 3 to 4 hours a day of deep work than in those 12-hour days I used to push when I honor the recovery and the rest, and especially do so without guilt. I think that's a big piece, especially for women. We can feel guilty about needing rest, about honoring that, about needing time off, especially if we're moms. And I say this often too, is like those emotions kind of shape our experience of life. So we could be eating the perfect diet, but if we're eating it in a place of fear because we feel like everything's bad for us and it's going to kill us, we're still not going to maximally absorb the nutrients from that food because we're afraid of it. If we're trying to rest and recover, but we're just feeling guilty about it, we're not getting the maximal benefit of that rest and recovery because we're still in that kind of state of guilt. So I think it's a both and. I think it's a learning to actually prioritize and honor the time of rest and recovery, but also more importantly, to like reframe how we think about that so we can do that from a place of joy and nourishment and peace and not from a place of guilt or obligation, or we're not just like putting recover on our to-do list, but we're actually like building that into the cycle of our life.
And what have you found in terms of the timing even of the day for those high intense activities or even the high intense mental activities? Do those tend to be done best in the morning when the cortisol is higher? Or is this at different times of the day that you've found, like, what are the rhythms for when the body is optimally going to show up and be able to do some hard work?
There is a little bit of variation here based on kind of your own circadian factors. But in general, I feel like most people can do deep work really well in kind of the mid-morning to early afternoon phase. So kind of past that initial cortisol adenosine window in the morning and before people hit that kind of, some people hit a slump in the afternoon, that tends to be a sweet spot for a lot of people for the deep work, especially deep cognitive work. An exception to this would be for a lot of women, especially if you're going to do any kind of intense exercise, often early morning, especially, or even like early to mid-morning can be more stressful on the nervous system, especially if you haven't already sent those safety signals of eating enough nutrients and protein and hydrating and all those things, which can be hard to do if you're trying to do a 5 a.m. workout. So for a lot of women, working out in the mid-afternoon from a hormonal perspective is the best time for like high-intensity workout. So that's the one exception I put in the afternoon category. But as far as like deep work and cognitive work, for most people, kind of mid-morning to early afternoon, it tends to be the sweet spot.
Katie, this is going to change people's lives because this is not what culture drives us to do. Culture drives us to wake up at 5 a.m., grab that cup of coffee on the way out the door to the gym. And yet, as you're saying, it's actually driving more fear into our life and our biology than cues of safety. Cues of safety that everything is working for me. There's so much subtle fear that can be driving all of these things. And then it just stacks up. And like you say, back to the bathtub analogy, right? Then all of a sudden we're realizing that we are juggling so much that it's becoming overwhelming and it's too much for our body. And then we won't be able to keep up. Thank you for deciding to lean into this and take your journalism background and really lean into the health aspects for ourselves, for our family, for our kids. This has been incredible to see you and what you've been able to do in changing people's lives.
As Katie shared, when our modern environment makes our body's rhythms get off, it is harder to have the energy and internal resources to do trauma healing. Our bodies do want to heal, and they can when we give them the right inputs. Coming back to your question, Joe, about is there a better time of the day to do therapy? Well, let's look at the natural rhythms of your body and energy. In the mornings, cortisol and energy will be higher. Is that a good time for you? Or are you still at a place where that activation is too high for you to drop down and do inner work? Maybe the afternoon is better. Or maybe if your biology is mostly in the shutdown and your chronic functional freeze is stronger than other people's, the afternoon will have you too tired and the morning will be best for you. So track and align with your body's rhythms where they are right now so that you're not having to stimulate or suppress your biology to do the inner work. But you're doing it at a time that is aligned with your body's rhythms at this time, knowing it can change as you progress on the healing journey. If you would like to know more about how you can improve your environment and align with your body's rhythms, I suggest reading my book, which you can pre-order and already receive the first few chapters. The Biology of Trauma book, the foreword is written by Gabor Mate. It's on how the body experiences and holds fear, pain, and overwhelm, and how to heal. And at the time of this recording, you can pre-order it. And I am giving away over $400 worth of bonuses if you pre-order now. And you can order that on Amazon. I'll have the link for you in the show notes and then the link for you to get those bonuses once you pre-order. If you are ready to do the inner work, then the 21-day journey is how you start with me. And this is where we go on a journey into your nervous system and I teach you a very specific structured sequence of somatic self practices that are aligned with your body's need for safety and support, and then what I call attuned expansion, daily practices for 21 days. If this episode interests you and you want some related podcast episodes, you will want to look at episode 68 on sleep with my friend Susie Zink, and episode 82 on using biological rhythms to recover from trauma with Dr. Leslie Korn. They have a YouTube video that you can look at, which is on sleep as being a sign of strength, not weakness. I am here to save you time and money by bringing you practical information that will help you accelerate the healing journey. So please take a moment to subscribe or leave a review. Your reviews and feedback are how I know how to improve this podcast, bring you great content, and help others find the information that could change their life as well. I'm your host, Dr. Amy. Until next episode, lots of love.